Well, ladies and gentlemen, lo and behold, look who we found lurking outside with a quill pen in one hand and a book in the other, taking notes. Here he is, Dr. History.
Good morning, Zeb. How you doing this morning?
How's my buddy?
I'm doing great.
Well, good. What's cooking in the world of historical facts?
Well, you know, as you think about the events of the West that really helped carve out the West, there's a few very, very important things that happened. And one of the most important things was the gold rush.
Oh, absolutely, yes.
So that's what we're going to talk about here is the California gold rush and basically what it kind of spread out to be.
Did we ever have a gold rush here in the state of Idaho?
Not as much as, say, Colorado, Montana, Nevada, California. But, yeah, there was definitely gold mines, lots and lots of gold mines in Idaho.
Okay. We had...
Not really what you'd call a... Well, there was kind of minor gold rushes. You know, any time gold was discovered on this creek or this valley or whatever, yeah, they would swoop in and so kind of... There's the major gold rushes and then kind of the minor gold rushes.
No, we were better known for the potato rushes.
That's right.
Okay.
Golden potatoes.
There you go.
So, well, those fateful words, you know, gold discovered, you know, and this on the South Fork of the American River there in California actually set off one of the largest human avalanches since the Crusades swooped over the Holy Land. I mean, by the fall of 1848, over 10,000 men were chasing the dream of El Dorado, you know, over there in the foothills of the Sierra Nevadas. And by 1849, more than 30,000 men sailed to California, while another 41,000 just went overland. Well, within a dozen years, there would be 400,000 miners looking for that elusive pot of gold.
Mm. So,
but, you know, gold fever swept the nation, and everyone wanted in on it. Or at least they wanted to read about it. So newspapers, even so-called respectable papers, they tried to outdo each other with competition, printing, you could say, some fantastic stories. Interestingly enough, some were actually true or based on truth. But
okay.
Nevertheless, whatever the story, it all fueled that, that lust for a quick fortune. And one paper's lead article told about a hungry hunter who shot a bear, and as the bear tumbled over a small cliff and landed on a ledge, well, when the hunter went to retrieve his bear, he looked up the wall and saw a wide vein of quartz sandwiching a rich vein of pure gold.
Mm.
And again, that's one of those stories you gotta kind of take with a grain of salt. But another paper wrote about a claim making $40,000 a day. So a newspaper's bread and butter stories were really the first-hand accounts, and they were taken a lot of times from letters of people that they sent back to their families. So, in fact, here's a couple of samples. One headline said, "My little girl has made $25 a day panning for gold. My income is $150 a day on my claim." Or, "I took $1,000 from one panful." So you can imagine if you're back east and you're reading these headlines, I mean, and you're only making a couple of dollars a day, you know, you're going to think pretty hard about heading west.
Absolutely.
So. But, you know, however, simply getting to the gold fields was at least half the problem, both by sea and overland, and these were dangerous journeys. Those who couldn't wait for spring and had the money, they hopped on whatever ship was available, and they could sail around the Horn for San Francisco, which was actually about an 18,000-mile trip.
Mm.
Or a traveler could get off in Panama, which cut the trip in half, but he also added the risk of tropical diseases, you know, malaria, stuff like that, in addition to the risk of traveling by mule and canoeing across the isthmus and then hoping to catch another ship onto California. And, you know, I've got to admire these guys. I've had people tell me about going around the Cape there in a cruise ship, and the water, I guess, can get so rough that half the crew is sick. So I don't envy those guys in a sailing ship going around there.
How long did it take, time-wise? What was it, about a three-month tour?
You know, I think it was. 18,000 miles, you know, from New York all the way around.
So holy smokes.
You know, 3 to 4 months. And like I say, if they got off at Panama, and if a ship stopped in Panama on the western side, they had to just hope that they had enough room to throw another guy on board. So it was a risk.
Once you made the commitment to go on this trip, really, you were really making a commitment.
Right. And like I say, sometimes they would actually wait for months down there in Panama because there might be ship after ship come by, but they may not have enough room for it.
Yeah, that's true.
So, but like I say, the sea journeys, they were quite rough. And in the hopes of making a large profit, a lot of these captains and ship owners filled every corner of their vessels. So supplies were literally worth their weight in gold, but, you know, greedy owners, they would not turn down cash-paying customers, and food and water on these voyages were bad. There was a lot of sickness because of the overcrowding, and I don't know if you've ever been seasick, Zeb, but I just can't imagine being on a crowded ship and then going up and down and up and down out on the ocean.
Oh, I have. As a matter of fact, the first time I really had seasickness, we were on a whale-watching tour in a relatively small little dinghy, and for some reason sitting out there going up and down on the ocean.
I've done that, and it's no fun.
I wanted to go home real fast.
Yes, I agree with that. Now, so that was bad enough. Now, going overland was probably more dangerous. In fact, in April of 1849, they had a really bad cholera epidemic that hit a lot of the wagon trains. So besides the disease, of course, there were the physical elements of wagon travel, you know, broken wheels, flooded rivers, the steep mountains, you know, your animals dying on you, and then, of course, trying to restock your supplies, and then, of course, always the threat of Indians. So now, while it did become kind of a mass migration, the beginnings of the California gold rush were a little more humble. I mean, the gold fever concept was really one of the more successful advertising campaigns in Western history, pushed by both business and governments. Without this kind of extra help, there still would have been a gold rush, but it may not have been quite such a national obsession. And so often happens, the men who were responsible for the discovery of gold in California really didn't capitalize on their discovery. Now, the one guy that everybody's heard about is John Sutter.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he'd knocked about in the far west for nearly 10 years before he decided to settle down and carve out his own empire in California. So he built a nice home on a rich section of land in the Sacramento Valley. And this was about, 1830, right in there. So he was close to the Sacramento and American rivers. Now, he was a pretty cautious man, so he actually constructed a fort. It was called Fort Sutter. And within a few years, his settlement kind of thrived and grew. He built a mill, a tannery, a winery. He planted wheat in the fields. He developed herds on the pasture lands, and he hired local Indians to work for him. And this guy was from Switzerland. He was a Swiss guy, and he made a really nice, comfortable living, fairly prosperous, and he raised enough for his own needs, and then he sold whatever extra he had to other settlers. Well, after about 10 successful years, Sutter had prospered to the point where he needed a lumber mill to provide materials for his expansion plan. Well, besides, it would be good business, so he could make a small fortune selling his lumber to his neighbors. So since Fort Sutter was built on the plains, there was very little usable lumber right around there. So Sutter knew of several good places to cut timber, so he didn't have time to do the work himself, so he hired a guy by the name of Marshall. Now, he sent Marshall to scout out locations for this new mill, and with Sutter's blessings, Marshall decided the best location was about 40 miles to the northeast on what they call the South Fork of the American River. Now, according to their agreement, Sutter would underwrite the cost of the mill, and Marshall would run the day-to-day operation. Well, by the end of the summer, Marshall had broken ground for the operations on the site. He built a cabin, he built a lumber mill building, and a small dam. Well, so January 24th, 1848, Marshall was walking down the ditch looking at his handiwork when he noticed some pieces of yellow flake. Well, he got a tin plate, he went down to the river to pan the contents. Well, it didn't take him very long to see that he had some color in his panning.
Mm-hmm.
And he thought this was kind of curious. So that night, he opened the gate on the dam, ran some water through the ditch again. The next morning, he shut off the gate, let the ditch dry out, and again walked down this ditch and found a piece of gold half the size of a pea. Now, that may not sound very big, but really, it was, you know, fairly substantial.
Absolutely.
Well, he called his men over, and he showed them, and by now, he was kind of getting a little excited, as you can imagine, when you talk about gold fever. And in fact, he says, my eye was caught by something shining in the bottom of the ditch. I reached my hand down and picked it up, and it was gold, no question. So after kind of collecting himself, he rode off to Fort Sutter in a pounding rainstorm, and Marshall explained the situation to Sutter behind closed doors, and he asked if he could test the nuggets and the dust. Well, he showed Sutter his poke of pouring out a handful of this gold dust and little tiny nuggets, and anyway, Sutter inspected the gold and performed some tests to make sure that it really was gold. And several days later, Sutter rode out to the mill to take a look at the find for himself. Now, he told the men to keep the discovery private. Well, you know how that goes. And while he considered what to do. Well, he went to the local Indians, and he bought up the land all around the mill for practically nothing, because he anticipated what was going to happen. Well, there's a man by the name of Sam Brannan. Now, keep this guy in mind a little
bit.
He's kind of an entrepreneur. And he had an eye for business. Well, Sam Brannan established a flour mill and started a newspaper called the California Star. And this was the first newspaper in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when he heard about the gold strike, he planned to capitalize. He wasn't interested in picking or panning. He felt the biggest profit could be realized by outfitting and selling to the miners. And we know from past stories that that's where a lot of people really made their money, was mining the miners, so to speak. Well, Brannan started by opening up a store near Sutter's Mill, which he stocked with food and picks and shovels and pans and all the gear that a miner needed to work. And gold in California was nothing new. Claims had been filed from time to time with some success. For example, in Los Angeles, there had been a gold strike, but just didn't make the headlines like this one did. Well, this Brannan guy, he did his best to publicize the find. He promoted the discovery. He walked through San Francisco waving his hat for folks to gather around, and he held up a bottle of nuggets and dust, you know, shouting, gold, gold, you know. And well, by June, the rush was on in that region, and nearly all of Sutter's workers deserted him to go dig for gold. And accounts say that San Francisco nearly became a ghost town, because every man who could pick up a shovel was heading for the foothills to get rich. Well, in August, the military governor, Colonel Mason, made an official tour of the gold fields. And he figured that more than 4,000 men were working the fields, and the number was growing, and they suggested that some of the best claims were producing $30,000 to $50,000 a day.
Wow.
So, you know, back in that day, 1848, 49, $30,000 to $50,000 a day. So,
I have a question here, though. I have a question.
Okay.
Why in the world, and I'm sure this has struck you while you were doing your research on the gold fields and everything, why wouldn't the people that found gold keep their mouths shut and want more of it for themselves?
You know, time and time again, I've seen that. They just can't keep their mouths shut.
Yeah.
Typically, they head to town and have a few drinks, and pretty soon they're telling everybody everything.
And then you have your great...
A lot of times end up dead.
There you go. Yeah.
So, but anyway, this gold strike was a really good thing. President James Polk was president then, and they'd recently had the Mexican War, and California was one of the acquisitions of that war. But with gold, he figured that that would be a great thing for the country to help kind of restock their money supply. And again, newspaper headlines told of overnight fortunes. Money was to be made not just in gold, but in outfitting all these men that were headed out there. Well, Sutter, let's get back to him. He was never able to sell the land that he had bought from the Indians because so many people swamped in. The claimed sales were hopeless. He had no way of enforcing his trespassing laws. And by the end of the summer, more than 10,000 men were looking for gold.
Mm.
And San Francisco was basically kind of deserted. I mean, it did become a boom town overnight.
Mm-hmm.
And at one time, even the banks were open 24 hours a day. Now, here again, here's where the miners got mined. In 1849, a boarding house might have 20 to 100 cots in one room.
Oh, my.
20 to 100. Just in one room.
Oh.
And a cot cost $20 a week for an 8-hour shift. In other words, you only got your cot for 8 hours, and then you were out.
Oh,
the next guy got the next 8 hours.
Huh.
So, anyway, you had to supply your own bedding. Now, a lot in town that sold for $21 in 1847 mice sell for 5,000 to 7,000 in 1849, and the same lot a few years later, 30,000 to 40,000 for a lot in San Francisco.
You know, and really, we complain about inflation today, but 150 years ago, they had inflation that was almost, when you figure the percentages, worse than it is today.
Oh, yeah, huge, yeah. And by 1847, you know, there was less than 500 people in San Francisco. 2 years later, there was at least 25,000.
Holy cow.
Anyway, the strike spread out from Sutter's Mill. North of Sutter's Mill, they had mines up there that two mines took over 300 pounds of nuggets and dust in 2 weeks. 300 pounds. And in fact, there was one story where some miners stopped to catch some fish. They cooked their salmon and they started to clean up dishes. And as they cleaned up their dishes, they found gold in the bottom of the pot they'd been cooking the fish in.
Oh, my.
Cleaned up in the creek.
Huh.
So, anyway, the gold strike lasted until about the mid-1850s, and they figure about $400 million worth of gold found its way to San Francisco alone, and altogether about $600 million in gold was taken from those gold fields by about 1860. Now, while the California gold strike was probably the most important in the 1800s, as I mentioned, as far as settling the West, it really wasn't the most lucrative. The famous Nevada Comstock lode, which is right over in there, produced over $400 million in 1859. And then the Black Hills Homestake Mine in 1876, they figure it produced $1 billion in gold.
Holy
probably
smokes.
The single richest mine in history.
Oh, my.
Dollars back then.
Goodness sakes. The only guy that was left in San Francisco was Paladin.
Yeah, that's right. Or Soapy Smith.
Yeah.
But now in Deadwood, South Dakota, over 100,000 worth of gold a day was being transacted. And then in Colorado, mines there have produced more gold overall than even California.
Wow.
But like I say, there were other areas that really produced more. Like I say, Deadwood, and then you get up into Nevada, the Virginia City area. I mean, there's just lots of gold that was taken throughout the whole West.
What caused the declination of the search, or the rabid search for gold? I mean, what was the last straw?
You know, that's a good question. I think it just gradually, it's one of those things that as they would rush from one strike to another strike to another strike, I think some of these guys just finally got to the realization that they weren't going to make big bucks. And I think some of them just finally gave up and went home.
Yeah.
And then there's those that did make a lot of money and just quit. And I think that it got harder and harder to mine these mines.
Yeah.
Or these gold strikes. And that's when they started bringing in these, what they call these stamps. That would they'd pull out the ore, stamp the ore, and then they'd use other methods to get the gold out of the ore.
Well, you know, they always
harder and harder for just a single miner with a pan.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, they always said that being a hard rock miner, you know, or a gold miner, boy, you can make your fortune, but you know something, for the one that might make it, there were literally hundreds and hundreds and hundreds that they broke their backs or broke their souls and ended up with nothing.
Right. Well, we've talked about the Klondike and the thousands of men that went into the Klondike, and so relatively few actually really made any money.
Yeah, well, I know living proof of one that made it big, and he went to chiropractic school and made it millions and millions of dollars. Dr. Ken Turner, you might know him.
Yeah. Well, that's a well-kept secret in Burley, Idaho. So well-kept, I don't think he even knows it.
You know, you did it again with a great story, and doggone it, it's always good to have you on the air. But we want to remind everybody real quick before we run out of time, dr-history.com. What does that mean?
Dr-history.com. You can go listen anytime, anywhere, even when you're driving down the road on your smartphone, to any of probably 12 or 15 stories we have on there now, including today's story. And I actually checked on the stats, and we actually have listeners in Japan, China, Europe, South America, and I don't know where these people are hearing about us, but we're actually getting listeners from really literally all over the world right now.
Holy cow, we haven't severed relations with any country, have we?
Well, that's why we got to keep this family oriented.
Okay. Dr. History, you always do such a great job, Dr. Ken Turner. And by the way, this weekend's going to be a special day for you, and I salute you as being one of the nicest guys in the world.
Well, I appreciate it, Zev. It's been, you know, as you know, I'm retiring, and I'm just looking forward to a little more free time, and I've got a nephew that's taken over for me, and he's going to do a great job here in my office.
All right. Well, listen, I thank you so much, but we're going to continue on with Dr. History.
You bet we will.
All right. God bless you, man. Thank you.
You have a good day, Zach.
All right. Remember, if you want to listen to these podcasts, be sure and write it down, dr-history.com. Okay? Very, very interesting.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.